In Tijuana, Mexico, migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. used to wait in big temporary camps. Those camps are no longer there. Our reporter went looking for where people are waiting now.
I was in an apartment building last night where every single room was occupied by people waiting to enter the United States. Four to a room, six to a room, just plain mattresses put on the floor.
Also, with so much mistrust fueling the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo, can a beloved former star of the NBA raise awareness and make a difference?
I think our role is my voice, and I think when I speak, people listen.
That's Dikembe Mutombo, and I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could be with us today. The Trump administration is vowing to fight a federal judge's decision that blocks one of the White House's new immigration rules, a plan that would have barred almost all asylum applications at the U.S.-Mexico border. The measure required migrants to apply for asylum in the first country they traveled through on their way to the U.S., so that policy is now on hold. The World's Monica Campbell has been talking to those at the center of these decisions. She's at the Mexican border near San Diego. Where exactly, Monica?
Well, I'm actually in Tijuana, and I'm in the plaza. When you cross over from, you know, near San Diego into Tijuana, you just cross through the border. You enter this plaza. It's very placid. There are a lot of pigeons. There's an elderly man feeding the pigeons in front of me. Cabs pulling up, picking up people. But, you know, as I just walk around the corner here, there is a totally different scene, and it's hundreds of people, asylum seekers, migrants, who are waiting to see if perhaps their number, when their number might be called up, so that they can go and approach a border official in the U.S. and perhaps enter the U.S.
So if Trump had his way, if this California judge had not stepped in, an asylum seeker coming overland from Honduras, for example, would have to cross Guatemala. And that, per Trump's idea, is where they'd have to stay. Now that the judge in California has stopped that for the time being, does that mean that asylum seekers will now be granted those interviews? Will they be able to cross the border from Mexico to the U.S.?
So if you're an asylum seeker and you're wanting to come through a port of entry, you're putting your name on a list. I mean, just like I'm seeing people do right in front of me. So that's one way, and that will continue. The other way with the judge's decision is that you could go in between a port of entry and seek asylum and ask for asylum at a, you know, from a border official after you've crossed the border and then continue on with the process there. It can go many different ways, depending on whether you're, you know, with children or not, or you're a single man. I mean, it depends. So that's a process that will continue. I've definitely talked to a number of people this week who are planning on crossing between ports of entry. That is a reality.
The Trump scheme last week was to actually deepen the restrictions on entry. Explain this third country rule that the judge has now put a stay on.
The judge stated that Mexico in particular, that there's overwhelming evidence, he said, that asylum seekers are not safe in Mexico, that it's not a safe country. And when you talk to people who are waiting here in Mexico to cross over to the United States, it becomes very clear that for many people, it isn't safe. I spoke to a young man from Honduras yesterday who's been here for, I think, over 6 months. And he fled Honduras. His father was killed, he said. He was a political activist. And as we're walking along to the hotel room where he's staying, he showed me fresh wounds on both of his forearms from being stabbed, cut, while somebody here in Tijuana tried to steal his cell phone, because every migrant here has a cell phone. And he told me, he said, I've got to get out of here. And then you have families, moms with little kids who aren't leaving rooms. They literally are not leaving the room that they're staying in. They don't often feel safe in the neighborhoods that they're staying in. And that's the reality for a lot of migrants. And I think that what we saw from the judge's decision is that that was understood. That asylum seekers here to be kept here indefinitely, it's not the ideal place. And, you know, the homicide rates in Mexico are going up.
So for that young man, the third country would have been Mexico. But as you've just described, it seems too unsafe for him to stay there. He really needs to be in a safer place, i.e. where he wants to go, the U.S.
I asked him, I said, could you stay here? I mean, he's making friends. He was going to a cafe in the evening to meet with a couple other fellow Hondurans. And I asked him, I said, could you picture your life here? And he said, no.
So a judge put a stay on this rule, but a lot of groups and immigration attorneys have responded to many of these new Trump rules on immigration by suing to block them. Not just this case, but others, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's this back and forth we see where the Trump administration puts out a new rule or policy, and then not even 24 hours passes before you see ACLU or other groups come back with a lawsuit, and there's varying degrees of success.
The White House says it's going to fight this. Do you think they'll succeed?
It's unclear. It depends on the judges, depends on the circuit, depends on ultimately perhaps the Supreme Court.
The world's Monica Campbell on the border at Tijuana. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
North Korea tested more ballistic missiles this week, also unveiled a submarine that could be able to carry nuclear weapons. And then there's the snow crabs. Today we learned that North Korea seized a Russian fishing boat last week, a boat that was in North Korean waters looking for snow crabs. The crab meat fetches a high price in international seafood markets, and it's a big earner for North Korea's economy, which is struggling under U.S. and international sanctions. Neil Bhatia is with the Center for New American Security. Neil, I never thought the geopolitics of North Korea would lead me to talking snow crabs, but just how important are these crabs and other fisheries to the North Korean economy right now?
So it's a pretty important cash crop for North Korean exports. Obviously, their economy is on more or less lockdown thanks to U.S. and United Nations sanctions, but they operate a quite vast illicit economy, and selling fish outright and selling fishing rights as well are two ways that they have historically made ends meet.
I mean, Trump might tout his special relationship with Kim Jong-un, but North Korea is still under heavy U.S. sanctions. Are these crab, are these fish exports subject to those sanctions? And if they are, how are they sold and who's buying?
Yeah, so they're absolutely covered as one of the exports that's restricted by United Nations sanctions in particular, but that hasn't stopped a lot of actors on the international stage from trying to make money through this. And you're talking mostly about transnational criminal networks, smuggling networks, some of which operate across the Chinese-North Korean border, and then a lot of them operate in the maritime space. So obviously, if you're talking about fishing, it's quite easy to take a fishing cargo, transfer it to another ship, relabel it as fish from somewhere else, and then sell it on the open market. And I mentioned before, the sort of licensing scheme is one way that the regime makes money. What they do is identify mostly Chinese fishing vessels who are able to pay, you know, about $7,000 or a month or so for the privilege of fishing in North Korean waters, which is also something that's restricted by the current sanctions regime, and they get a cut of the sale, so it's quite lucrative for all concerned.
It does seem snow crabs are a pretty lucrative commodity for the North Korean economy. As for food generally for North Koreans, we see that the agricultural harvest is not forecast to be good this year, and it's only 20 years since a long famine ended in North Korea. Is there anything like a food emergency approaching again?
So that's another interesting question. Solid data is hard to get out of North Korea, but from the indications we're hearing, particularly from South Korean analysts who follow this quite closely, that the fuel restrictions that are part of that sanctions package are sort of trickling down to everyday North Korean farmers whose quotas for fuel for tractors, for example, are now quite low. And as a result, you've seen a decline in the harvest. You've seen a decline in overall economic activity. So I think the prospect of that slowing economic growth is again raising the specter of, you know, are we on the doorstep of another famine? I don't think there's anything solid to indicate that as of yet, but I think there are warning signs that we're seeing in the North Korean economy writ large.
You did say, Neil, that the data can be opaque, but overall, just how much of a squeeze is Kim Jong-un facing financially?
So I think we need to separate what is happening to Kim and his elite inner circle and the wider North Korean population. I think everyday North Koreans who are not part of the regime are most certainly feeling a significant economic pinch. The agricultural production numbers are just one part of that we're seeing. How much pinch the elites are feeling is less certain. All of these illicit networks are ultimately serving what they want. So they may be feeling slightly constrained on the margins, but I don't think it's yet risen to the level where he feels like he has a significant internal pressure from those who are immediately around him. He feels like he has time to spare and that this process with the Americans is something that he can manage.
Neil Bhatia with the Center for New American Security in Washington. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
For about 2 weeks now, protesters have been taking to the streets of Puerto Rico in droves. One of their goals was to get Puerto Rico's embattled governor to resign. And late last night, after a few dramatic hours of rumor and uncertainty, Ricardo Rosselló went on Facebook Live and announced his resignation.
Hoy les anuncio que estaré renunciando al puesto del gobernador.
In the video, Rosselló said he had heard the demand of the people and would leave office on August 2nd. Celebrations broke out across the island. Maria Torres Lopez was among those celebrating. She's from Puerto Rico and is there now, but she's been living in Florida for the past 15 years.
Our people are finally rising up and seeing the truth of everything that's been happening here for a few decades now.
How did you
it's very refreshing.
How did you react when you heard the news?
I was ecstatic. I couldn't believe it, and I cried, and I smiled, and I woke up my husband, and there was a lot of emotions.
Yeah, the news came kind of late, so people were asleep, and yeah, I guess you got to wake people up to give them the news.
Yes.
So there were so many issues that brought people to the streets to demand Rosselló's resignation. There were, of course, the leaked text messages between Rosselló and some of his aides where they mocked victims of Hurricane Maria, homophobic and other offensive language as well. Also, corruption charges against two officials in his administration, and then just a lot of sore feelings about how Rosselló handled the federal aid after Hurricane Maria. Of all of these things, what got you out to protest?
All of them. One is more important than the other. I think what we're seeing is everything that our people, and when I say our people, I mean the people in Puerto Rico, have said for a few years now was true. The agencies that are supposed to oversee all the restructuring, they're just not doing their job. And people here knew that. People here were screaming to the top of their lungs saying there's something wrong. This is not working the way it's supposed to. And nobody was listening.
Have you met other people in recent days who have gone back to the island over, you know, the past few weeks to protest? And you know,
yes. As of right now, there's a few hundreds of people from the diaspora. And that came specifically for this. We decided to just join not only via social media to help with the mobilization and also to help with what's coming up next, because we understand that Ricky Renuncia is not the end, but rather the beginning of a much larger struggle.
Right. Ricky Renuncia, that's been kind of the trending hashtag, Ricky step down, governor step down.
Correct.
What would it take for these current protests to cease? What do you ultimately want for Puerto Rico?
A complete overhaul of the politics and the way the government has been run.
So basically, you see the current political situation in Puerto Rico as kind of a monopoly between two parties, and you want that to change?
Absolutely.
What will happen to the old political parties? I mean, there's still people within those parties, aren't there, that other Puerto Ricans trust? No?
I'm sure they will evolve. They don't want to die, so they have to evolve. And part of that evolution is to be truthful. I mean, truthful with their people, because their own people are fed up with them and they don't want to take it anymore.
Maria Torres Lopez speaking with us from Adjuntas, Puerto Rico. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, one Italian's dream comes true of a truly epic rock concert in his backyard. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A few years ago here on the show, we mentioned this crazy story about how an Italian fan of American rock music convinced his favorite band to perform in his hometown. Today, we're going to hear the story behind that story and meet the man who made it all happen. He's been speaking with the BBC's Neil Rozelle. That man's name, Fabio Zaffagnini.
I'm a geologist. I love rocks and rock.
Fabio lives in the small Italian city of Cesena, where big rock and roll acts rarely play. Fabio says he spent a small fortune traveling around Italy to see his favorite bands, but he really wanted to see Foo Fighters at home in Cesena. And that desire started a bonkers idea that nearly took over his life.
If I wanted to have them, I had to invent something, create something crazy, make the whole world talk about this, and eventually convince Foo Fighters to come to Cesena. I remember like 10 years before, I saw a movie whose name was School of Rock.
What you're about to see is me begging Led Zeppelin to use their song.
Where Jack Black pleads Led Zeppelin to give them the opportunity to use one of their songs for the movie.
We need your song, man.
And he makes this plea together with like 1,000 people screaming.
Something you really need. You might have to get on your knees with 1,000 people behind you screaming.
So this idea of 1,000 people screaming and going crazy, going nuts to obtain something really stayed in my mind for like 10 years. And at some point, while driving my car close to a park in Cesena, I started to think of this mass of people singing and screaming. And this is where my idea came up. So, okay, let's make the biggest tribute ever made to a rock band. And this is how it all started. The idea was ask 1,000 musicians to perform simultaneously in the same place, 250 singers, 250 drummers, 350 guitar players, and 150 bass players, all synchronized one song of Foo Fighters. And at the end of the video, make this plea to Dave Grohl, who is the lead singer, and hope that the band sees it and decides to come. It's a kind of crazy idea, I know. I just wanted to do something crazy with my friends. I'm a marine geologist. I never organized an event before. So first thing I did was to ask my friends. We had to find the money. We have to find musicians. So we started a crowdfunding campaign to raise all the musicians. We made a website, and all musicians had to apply, send us a link of them while playing or singing. So we made a kind of online audition. And we had like kids, old people, boys, girls. While looking at all these videos, we really perceived the passion of all these people. This whole thing started as a joke. And slightly, without really realizing, it became a kind of obsession. I mean, I started thinking of it like every morning. Every night my dream was same. While waking up and every night before going to sleep. And I used to think all the time about how to make this happen.
So after more than a year of obsessing, the day of the show finally arrived. The big number would be Foo Fighters' Learn to Fly.
We were in this big park. From the beginning of the day, we started to see all these musicians with their own instruments gathering and coming from every region of Italy. There were like cables and wires everywhere. We had this stage in the center with the orchestra director that had to like conduct this mass of wild rockers.
After rehearsing, 1,000 musicians began to play.
I was asking myself if that was really happening, you know. It was so big, so crazy, so incredible. To listen to so many musicians all together, I mean, there's the earth shaking. It was like a new sound experience. The wall of sound is so thick, it's like getting a slap in your face. And when you see that something that seems impossible becomes possible, I felt very proud.
One 1,000 rockers, and they just did for one song, your song. So our call is to ask you, the Foo Fighters, to come and play for us, give a concert to all of us in Cesena.
Fabio was hoping the video of the performance would go viral. It did. It's had 48 million views, including at least one from Dave Grohl, who posted his own reply.
And Dave Grohl said, "Che bello, che bellissimo," thank in Italian. Thank you very much.
Questo video, che bellissimo, grazie mille.
We will come soon, I promise.
Stiamo arrivando, prometto.
I thought it was like a joke. I mean, Dave Grohl replying after one day and accepting our invitation. And they decided to open their European tour in Cesena. The night of the concert, I wasn't sure about where to look at. I didn't know if it was better for me to look at the stage and see Foo Fighters performing, or to look at the bleachers where all my friends were crazy happy about what we did. At some point during the concert, Dave Grohl played My Hero, and he dedicated this song to me. There was all the public screaming my name and clapping hands, and I did crowd surfing on the people, and then I went on stage. It's been crazy. I know that I say the word crazy so many times, but I cannot find any other word to describe all this. And still now, it seems like it's been a dream and it didn't really happen.
Fabio called the band Rockin' 1000. He now gathers people from all over to perform as the world's largest rock band.
Yeah, I'll go with crazy. Neil Rizel reporting there. His story originally ran on the BBC's Outlook program. The market for methamphetamines in Asia is growing fast. It's now worth $60 billion a year.
It's hard to surprise me anymore at the rate that this meth trade is growing, but even I was surprised by these numbers.
Why meth is booming in Asia and who's behind it. I'm Marco Werman. That story and more coming right up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. The United Nations just released a report with some really eye-popping figures. The methamphetamine market in Asia is now worth $60 billion. That's billion with a B. It's more than the GDP of several countries in the region. This is something the world's Patrick Wynn follows closely. He wrote a book called Shadowlands about Asia's drug trade. So I asked him to break down the numbers for us.
It's hard to surprise me anymore at the rate that this meth trade is growing, but even I was surprised by these numbers. So $60 billion, that's the estimated value of Asia's meth market, and this is rooted in the mountains of Myanmar. Largest meth market in the world, and it has quadrupled in just 5 years. So when I first started looking at the meth trade in this region, it was $15 billion. So it has just shot up and up and up.
Right, now it's $60 billion. Why did it go up so much?
Well, smugglers have been very successful at getting crystal meth to wealthy countries. Australia is getting a lot of it. To a lesser extent, they're getting it into South Korea and Japan. So if you can get your methamphetamine from the meth lab in Myanmar to South Korea, you're going to make a lot of money. And I can illustrate this with an example. Near the meth labs, you want a gram of crystal meth. It'll probably cost you about $15. If you sell that on the streets of Seoul or Tokyo, you can get $400 to $500.
So you could say that's value added just for transportation and distribution. But I mean, it also must say something about the demand in places like Japan or South Korea.
Yeah, it's growing there, but in Australia, it is very much entrenched. And Australia is getting a lot of the stuff. It comes over in really big shipments. Just last month, there was the largest ever meth seizure in Australia's history. It was caught in a port. And those drugs were produced in Myanmar, 1.6 tons of crystal methamphetamine. That's a lot.
Put this into context for us, Patrick, because these big numbers can start to feel meaningless. Is there a comparison to be made between like the meth market in Asia and the drug cartel industry that crosses the U.S.-Mexico border?
There is sort of a relationship because if you want to operate a meth lab successfully, you need to find a territory that can't be raided because your cartel runs it or you're in with the police. And so Mexico has that environment and the buyers are all in the U.S. Similar thing happening here. It's all made in Myanmar. All the financiers go to Myanmar to work with armed groups there to set up those methamphetamine factories, and then they're trying to push it out to the more affluent countries. One more thing about comparing the two. Along the U.S.-Mexico border, we've seen absolutely shocking violence. I have to give the Asian drug syndicates credit. The level of violence, while significant, is much lower. They don't seem to have such vicious infighting. There seems to be a symbiotic relationship between the different syndicates. One will acquire the chemicals. One will provide the security. One will traffic it. They're all experts in different aspects of the drug trade. And so for some reason, it seems to be more peaceful.
Why do you think that is?
I have been thinking about that a lot, and I don't have a really clean answer. But I will say this. The United States has an ongoing drug war where they've gone in and broken up the trade and knocked out one big player. And so that sets up a squabble between two smaller players to be on top. You don't really have that happening over here in Southeast Asia.
That's the world's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
One more number, Marco, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. $1 trillion.
What's that?
That is how much China says it'll spend on its Belt and Road Infrastructure project. This is a big global project to stitch together the world through these arteries of transport, highways, ports, and so on. And so as they are creating new pipelines through Asia, these pipelines can be used by mafias and drug syndicates to smuggle drugs. It's easier to move drugs from A to B.
And just to be clear, China's Belt and Road project isn't built intentionally for drug dealers. I mean, it's being exploited by them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's meant to move around tennis shoes and circuit boards and traders who want to move around from A to B. But wherever you have sort of an artery of transport, underground syndicates will look to that and find a way to exploit it. So even though there's no nefarious intent in building this highway, in fact, it could be helpful for the economies of certain regions, the dark economy will slither in and find a way to exploit it as well.
The world's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. Patrick, thanks as always.
Thanks so much.
Dikembe Mutombo, pretty famous among NBA fans in the 1990s and early 2000s. His 7-foot frame ruled the basketball court, racking up records, earning him a spot in the Hall of Fame. But that pales in comparison to the celebrity and stature that Dikembe Mutombo has in his native Congo, where he's built a hospital and is an influential force in public health.
Bonjour. Je m'appelle Dikembe Mutombo. Je m'adresse à vous aujourd'hui.
This is a recent PSA Mutombo made for the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Ebola est une réalité et la situation est difficile.
Speaking directly into the camera, he tells viewers that Ebola is real and how to prevent it and get treatment. Fighting Ebola is a current focus of Dikembe Mutombo's extensive humanitarian work. He was in the DRC this month and just returned to his home in Atlanta.
I'm not going to stop spreading the word to educate my people until we understand that the virus have gone.
We've been hearing so much about mistrust about Ebola in the east
yes.
of the country. And even this week, you probably know the health minister resigned over frustrations
yes.
and how the response is being handled. How deep is the mistrust of the vaccine, of foreigners, even Congolese health workers?
I think the mistrust come from the fact that people in the Uturi, in the province where the pandemic have touched, they have suffered long enough, almost for the last 20 years, and they have not seen the outside world come to them to rescue them, to help them. Then suddenly the virus came in, the pandemic of Ebola came in, ravaged the entire region. Then we see more jeep and 4x4 being driven but people with the white coats that we never seen before. So those people are wondering, okay, you came now, you want me to be treated. What were you when my wife, my daughter, my son had been killed or been raped? Why you never came for 20 years? And I think that what kind of frustration is coming in. It will take a little bit of time for population to understand that these people came here to save your life, came here to improve your living condition and protect you. And we just need to gain trust from them.
Do you think Congolese are open to your messages of getting treatment? I mean, can the words of Dikembe Mutombo make a difference?
Of course. I think our role is my voice. You know, I'm the man of a big statue around the globe. And I think when I speak, people listen. When I was in Congo, I was applauded by almost everyone that I encountered from the airport all the way to the city.
Did you manage to travel to the east of the DRC to see what's going on in those provinces?
No. That's part of the region that I never got a chance to go in through my lifetime. Hopefully one day I will. But let's work with the partners who are on the ground. We all are praying. We just have to keep praying.
In terms of the health infrastructure in DRC right now, what does a country most need to fully eradicate this Ebola outbreak?
Education. You know, we were able to eradicate Ebola in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, and other parts of the world because of the education. We were able to eradicate Ebola in the Congo in 74, 78, and in the 90s, 94, 95, 97. All this time, Ebola have come back in the province in the northwest of Congo, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the jungle. They did that because of education. Like the Old Testament said, people perish because of lack of knowledge. So knowledge becoming a key here. So many people, where the Ebola is happening, they are so remote from the major city. So I think maybe we need to improve our distance of the radio so everyone can have access to the rest of the world with the communication.
Maybe it's about building a radio station and not a hospital.
No, we're still building a hospital. we're still building, but you cannot build a hospital almost in every area of the continent of Africa. But you can build a small community center and educate people.
Dikembe, one last question. This is about basketball, because I have to. You're one of the players getting a pro basketball league off the ground on the African continent. Your next stop is Senegal, I understand. What is the mega plan? When do things launch?
We are just so excited for this NBA league coming to African continent. The launching will take place in January 2020. That's when the league officially opens and its first game will be played in the continent. I'm just so happy that young Africans will have a chance to be exposed to the rest of the world, to the NBA, to NCAA, where they will be discovered. Africa is a continent full of talent. My dream was I didn't want to be the last African player playing in the NBA. And I dedicated myself 30 plus years ago that I will continue to go to the continent to lay the foundation of basketball, so to encourage more young people to join the game. NBA coming to Africa is a dream come true for Dikembe Mutombo.
Dikembe Mutombo, thank you very much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Of all the world's problems that stress you out, you probably don't spend much time thinking about asteroids hitting Earth, but maybe you should.
Guess what, guys? It's time to embrace the horror. Look, we got front row tickets to the end of the Earth.
All right, that's a scene from the 1998 movie Armageddon with Bruce Willis. But seriously, an asteroid almost hit Earth this week. It was traveling 15 miles per second and came closer than the moon's orbit. In space terms, that's really close. Chris Stanek monitors the sky for the group ASAS-SN at Ohio State. I asked him what he saw in that moment.
Well, so it takes a while, unlike the movies, it really took a few hours before. I mean, I knew something is exciting the moment I saw the image because it's moving so fast. And then we actually had data for it from both Texas and Hawaii. And it was kind of, it's there isn't this aha moment. It's more of like building up. And then as I am trying to put this information in the system, I'm also seeing people reacting to it and saying, okay, that's a big one. And it's kind of exciting.
Generally, isn't there a pretty good understanding, Chris, well in advance of any asteroid on track coming near Earth? So why was this asteroid not detected sooner?
So the large rocks we've known for quite a while. The first one was discovered in the 1800s. We've been discovering thousands of them. But the size distribution is such that there's many small rocks, and only now we have the technology to be able to find them. And again, this was unusual because it snuck up on us because it came mostly from the direction of the sun. And so we were only able to see it in the last day. And that was actually done using very small telescopes, not the bigger ones that usually discover these things.
I mean, it seems like a big deal, an asteroid of this size, I mean, 100 meters, but coming this close to Earth? I mean, what does that mean?
So I think what it tells us, it's maybe not the wake-up call, but it's telling us that we should probably look for these things a little bit harder, because if this hit Earth, it would create a crater 1 kilometer in size. It would wipe out a good-sized city, because that would be several megatons of equivalent of TNT.
Even if you had a month-long warning, what could people do? I mean, how can you prepare for one of these things?
So if you have a month and you know where it hits, you just evacuate. If you have 20 years and it's a really big one, then we can try to do some kind of Armageddon things, except not like Armageddon.
Right.
But the best scenario is to deflect it, to make it miss the Earth.
How does your organization, ASSSN, monitor the sky and detect things such as asteroids?
So we have 20 small telescopes. They're actually photo lenses deployed around the globe in four different sites: Hawaii, Texas, Chile, and South Africa. And we just take thousands of images every night. And we look at these images through software. And basically, most of the time, nothing happens. So there's stars in the sky, but they don't vary. But we have written the software that detects any changes. So if something changes and it's bright enough, we will see it.
I saw one astronomer quoted in Australia saying, though, at some point or another, there's going to be one of these asteroids with our number on it.
Anything can happen. I think probability game is such that won't happen for a few thousand years. So I would think about this as insurance. I buy car insurance despite the fact that I'm a safe driver because, you know, and you never know what happens. I think humankind is spending, you know, many billions of dollars on all kinds of things that we don't necessarily need, or, you know, to kill other people. I'm not a pacifist, but we should be probably spending on the order of $1 billion a year on this kind of detection system. And if we detect them, then we should also try to, you know, think what to do with this.
Chris Stanek, professor at Ohio State University, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
The stories of migrants creating a new home and new community, often in the face of racism, that's a pretty familiar theme right now. But it's also resonated for the women years ago who left the Caribbean for the UK during what's known as the Windrush Generation. From 1948 to 1971, migrants sailed to Britain to help fill the post-war labor shortage. A new stage production in London celebrates the stories of women who were part of that generation. The BBC's arts correspondent Rebecca Jones spoke with the creators of the opera Memories in Mind, Memories of the Windrush.
I've seen it as my role to document the stories of women like my mother and my aunts and their friends. Because that was something I hadn't really seen before, portrayed in opera, stories of women from the Caribbean of that generation that came over during the Windrush period.
The British composer Shirley J. Thompson wanted to give those women a voice by interweaving their experiences into an opera. Women were part of the Windrush Generation, a reference to the ship that brought the first workers to Britain in 1948.
In Jamaica, they couldn't find work. Discouraged but full of hope, they sailed for Britain.
London is the place for me.
Their spokesman sings his thanks to Britain.
London, this lovely city.
But the reality was very different for the women who inspired the opera.
My name is Ivy Jones.
Ivy Jones, who's 91, arrived in London from Jamaica 60 years ago. Living in just one room, her first job was in an asbestos factory.
They couldn't get nobody for that job because asbestos, first it was a bad thing and people don't want to work in it. And second, it was a cheap job. But black people have to take the job that English people don't want.
So did you feel unwelcome?
Yes, you feel unwelcome, but I didn't care about that. You know, English people didn't treat black people very well. The most men would say, why don't you go where you come from? But I said to them, no, you listen to me. You live in my country for 600 years. So you don't tell me that I don't belong here. I belong here. Slave labor build the economy. And that's my legacy. And I am going to get my share. And that just shut them up.
We worked and we toiled to build this land.
So recently I was waiting for a taxi, minding my own business. And a man asked me, why hadn't you gone back? Go back to where you've come from.
That was this year.
Mm-hmm.
Dame Jocelyn Barrow is 90. She's been living in this country since she arrived from Trinidad as a postgraduate student in 1959. She went on to help found the Campaign Against Racial Discrimination.
Great strides were made. We were making great improvement. We got black MPs, etc. And then with this Brexit situation, it has brought out people's... It has given them an authority. They feel a right to ask you why you're here and why haven't you gone back. The underlying message was we want to be a white, independent country, just as Trump is trying to do. And people take their cues from that and feel that they have the right and the liberty to become more racially abusive than they did in the past.
By showcasing the struggles of the Windrush women, Shirley J. Thompson hopes to share the lessons of the past with people in the present. And throughout her own career, she's faced plenty of challenges herself.
I've had many doors closed, phones not answered, and but I wouldn't be put down because I didn't get responses from key people. And I think I've had to be particularly resilient to keep going.
But do you think that your experience has been because you're a black woman?
Nobody has said that overtly, but I suspect that has been the case, yes.
Composer Shirley J. Thompson ending that story from the BBC's arts correspondent Rebecca Jones. A new species of shark was discovered in the Gulf of Mexico. It's called the American pocket shark. I'm looking at a picture of him right now. He's teeny tiny, about 5.5 inches long. He looks like a baby whale that you could just hold in your hand, and actually kind of cute. But don't be fooled by appearances, says Hank Bart. He's one of the scientists who discovered the species.
This little shark feeds by rasping a plug of flesh from the side of generally a larger fish.
So tiny and terrifying. In addition to devouring the flesh of its victims, the American pocket shark also squirts glow-in-the-dark fluid. It shoots from little pouches near its front fins.
That luminous fluid is serving some kind of a communication purpose, because for sharks like our little shark that live in deep water, you know, virtually lightless environment, they're using things like that luminous fluid or other little structures on the body called photophores, little light-producing organs. They're using that either to communicate with others of their own kind when attracting mates or to attract prey.
Bart says this little guy was caught during a study of the feeding habits of sperm whales.
The way they caught this shark was on a trawl sample, you know, pulling a net behind a boat, where they start at the surface, open the trawl, and let the trawl sink to 580 meters. And then they close the trawl as if the whale was closing its mouth. That little shark was found in one of those trawl samples. It was the only one found on the cruise, remarkably. Shows you how rare it is.
And he was found 10 years ago. The shark specimen was then frozen. Scientists didn't even know they had it until 3 years later. It took them another 7 years to determine it was actually a new species of shark. That process involved taking X-rays and CT scans at a lab in Grenoble, France, that can produce X-rays 100 billion times brighter than the machines used in hospitals. Barr says the discovery highlights how little we actually know about the Gulf of Mexico and what's living there.
There's no question that there are other discoveries like this that are going to come with more scientific sampling.
Hank Bard is the director of Tulane University's Biodiversity Research Institute. He was on the team of researchers that identified the new species of shark called the American pocket shark. Baby shark, baby shark, baby shark. We just had to hear that. The world's theme music was composed by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.